Mark Bartlett, the head librarian of the Society Library, and it's great to see a full room and an audience for this evening's presentation. Tonight we have a number of library members here and trustees in attendance, and I wanted to thank all of our members and trustees for their support of the library. Our annual appeal last year did very well, and it is because of the support of our members that we're able to have a great library with active programming, a children's library, wonderful reading rooms like our members' room, and the many things that happen in this building. I do know that we also have a number of guests in the audience from various constituencies on the Eastern Seaboard. Some people are here from as far away as Rutgers University, I believe. And we welcome some library school students as well from Pratt and a couple of other schools. We are kicking off our National Library Week celebration with this event, with the somewhat provocative title of The Book is Dead, Long Live the Book. I knew that when we gave it that name that it would definitely draw a few people. I do want to mention one thing about our other events this week during National Library Week. We do have Jules and Kate Pfeiffer on Thursday afternoon, and on Saturday we're having a reception and a talk by Brian J. Jones on Washington Irving, who is a former library member, and he was a trustee here, and of course a very important American writer. The Society Library, for those of you who don't know, is the oldest library in the city. It goes back to 1754, back when the word society had no real connotations of class. And the library's purpose was to improve the lives of New Yorkers by building a collection of books and making them available. We are still thriving 254 years later, and we are one of the last standing of the membership or subscription libraries in the United States, and we are one of three membership libraries here in New York City. I would like to thank, to start, Maggie Jackson, who will be our host and moderator for this evening. And Maggie is an award-winning writer and Boston Globe columnist, and she has a book that's coming out very shortly called Distracted, The Erosion of Attention and the Coming Dark Age. And she's also the author of another very interesting book I would recommend reading, What's Happening to Home? Balancing Work, Life, and Refuge in the Information Age. One final note before I hand the podium over to Maggie is that tonight we are testing our new sound system, everything from microphones to speakers to video recording and audio recording. So please bear with us if there are any mishaps or a little bit of feedback here or there, but I think everything should go smoothly. So without further ado, Maggie Jackson.
Well, thank you. I want to thank, first of all, Sarah Elliott Holliday, Caroline Waters, and Mark Bartlett for all the time they've put in putting together not only this event, but the program for National Library Week. So, have we come to bury this? Is the book going the way of the chainmail or butter churns? 174,000 books were published in the United States in a recent year, and yet 57% of Americans say they do not read a single book a year, fiction or nonfiction. Is MIT professor William Mitchell correct in saying that soon books will be cherished only by, quote, those addicted to tree flakes encased in dead cow? In the fluid, hyper-connected global digital age, books, some say, are solitary, isolating, unchanging. And of course, all this echoes Plato's lament about the written word. He said, writing can't answer back. It, quote, preserves a solemn silence. Or is it really the printed book that's dying? Will the Kindle, the Amazon new e-reader, spark a metaphorical fire that will reduce print to ashes for once and for all? 1 million books are being digitized a year. Now, so has the text flown free? Are we authors and publishers all? The next step, the universal library. A hyperlinked, easy-access soup of the written word. Kevin Kelly, the editor of Wired, says, it will be a very large single text, the world's only book. Well, were it that simple, then we could celebrate or mourn. Case closed. But really, pitting the technorati versus the literati diminishes our discussion of the book today. Tonight, we should be open-minded, perhaps dismantle some of the sacred assumptions we have about book versus screen. The book, is, for instance, is more mutable than we perhaps realize. Recall its iterations from the volume end to the penny chapbook, and remember its interactivity. Alberto Manguel says that we forget every text is in a very essential sense interactive, changing according to a particular reader or hour or place. Books have brought us to the doorstep of the digital age. And just as the digital has no monopoly on flexibility, so the book has no monopoly on authenticity. It wasn't until 1760 that Adrian John says the first printed book was printed without error. And an in-depth dive into the web today reveals troves of vetted, peer-reviewed, written in knowledge. So remember, the book and the screen are both vessels of the text, carriers in Michael Gorman's words. They're vessels of our hopes and dreams, of our curiosity, and they're both communication technologies, which history tells us have a way of overlapping in surprising and messy and dynamic ways. The cinema did not kill painting. The TV did not kill radio. And the New York Society Library had telephone service in 1900, which is brave because telephones were a broadcast medium in that day and age. So today, I see much evidence of synergy between these two carriers of the text. Bloggers, what is the mark of success of a blogger? A book contract. And where do critics of cyberspace vent their opinions? On the web. So before introducing our two esteemed panelists who will work their way into the intricacies of these thorny questions, I'd just like to throw out three questions for the evening, plant the seeds of these three questions. First, what role will the print and the digital word play in our lives? How can we harness their strengths? The digital gives us breadth, it emphasizes relationships and fluidity, and yet it can degenerate into fragmentation, even chaos. As Jim Neal has said, will we have information utopia or anarchy? Print gives us depth. It, as John Updike calls, edges, establish frameworks for sifting knowledge. And yet many bridle at what they say is the print age's unbending hierarchies of control. Two, what context do the book and the screen operate in? What is the milieu in which they will unfold? We live in a world of split focus. Information workers switch tasks every 3 minutes all day long, and it takes 25 minutes to circle back to your original work once you're interrupted. We live in a culture of lost threads, of alternative universes, of virtuality and speed. How will we read? I was one day sitting on the steps of the big 42nd Street main branch, having a cup of tea and a break and admiring the lions, and I saw a family of tourists marching up the steps, and dragging behind was a whining teenager who said, we don't come to the library at home. Why are we coming here? Well, why do we come here? Is the library going to be simply a permeable, portable information docking station or something more? And can the library lead us into the way of safeguarding the fragile digital historical record? And last, how do we wish to use these tools? What values do we bring to the question? In other words, what is literacy? I would argue at the moment we're not reading well at either format. In our nation, 30% of college graduates are proficient at reading a document, such as a newspaper. That's down from 40% in 1992. And in a recent test of college graduates nationwide, only 50% could judge the objectivity of a website. So young or old, tech-savvy or not, I don't think we're really navigating and evaluating what's in cyberspace. So luckily, we have two renowned authorities here to wade into these questions. Michael Gorman is past president of the American Library Association, and last year he retired as dean of library services at California State University, Fresno, after many decades as a librarian. An authority on matters related to libraries and the book on both sides of the Atlantic, He's known for his passionate defense of the crucial role of books and reading in our lives. And James Neal is Vice President for Information Services and University Librarian at Columbia, responsible for academic computing and for the university's 25 libraries, a system that is among the top five in academic research in North America. He's active in areas related to copyright, scholarly publishing, digital libraries, information standards, and intellectual freedom. Columbia is actively digitizing its collections and participating in the Microsoft and Google book projects. So we welcome them both, and Mr. Gorman will speak first.
Thank you very much. I would be even more in awe of speaking in a 254-year-old library had I not had the great honor of speaking 3 or 4 years ago at the 450th anniversary of the Bodleian Library in the Sheldonian, which is even more sumptuous a place in which to speak than this room. I think that our discussions of the book and the future of the book and the future of human communication are bedeviled by two things. One is misunderstanding, and the other is the kind of cartoonish approach to discussion that characterizes a lot of public life in the West today. For example, we fail very often to distinguish between information and knowledge. And I think it is arguable that libraries and the life of the mind are much more dependent on the transmittal and preservation of recorded knowledge than they are on questions of information. We're told we live in an information age, we're told that information is power, and so on. And it all turns out that, of course, that computers are very good at information and not very good at recorded knowledge. And I think that that is where the crux of the question about the place of the book as part of the human record resides. Another thing that we ignore, I think, is the idea that we are responsible as librarians, as researchers, as citizens, as a society, for not only access to the human record, but the preservation and onward transmittal of that human record. And I think if you look at the history of human communication from 8-9 millennia ago, when people started recording their thoughts, that you will see that that was a time, in Thomas Carlyle's words, where the age of miracles began. Because human beings only learn in three ways. They learn from experience, and we've been doing that ever since there were human beings. You know, you notice somebody eating a handful of red berries and dropping dead, and you tend to abstain from red berries from that point. We learn from interaction with people who know more than we do, teachers, rabbis, priests, you know, shamans, whatever. And we've been doing that since the first wise woman gathered some cave dwellers around her and told those people what she knew. And the third way we learn is from recorded knowledge, from reading, from the records of the past that have come down to us, because the knowledge you gain from experience dies with you. The knowledge from teachers dies with the teachers unless it's recorded. And we all know what the history of oral history is, that the testaments that people give get garbled over the years and the centuries and eventually attenuate and vanish. So the role of the librarian and the archivist, and I don't regard these as separate professions, I regard them as members of the same church but in schism. In fact, the archivists are the Protestants and the librarians are the Catholics with the rituals and their bibliographic Vatican in Washington, etc., etc. But anyway, the role of the librarian and the archivist is to ensure that future generations know what we know. And the argument is not about nostalgia and the pleasures of reading, the beauty of the book, the beauty of print. I'm as susceptible as anybody of my age and type to that kind of thing. The argument is about what is the best way to ensure that future generations know what we know. And if you look at that history of human communication, it's possible to think that the last 500 years have been an aberration, an island of fixity, authenticity, onward transmission, in which very few texts, very few textual parts of the human record have completely died. And if you contrast that with the era that preceded it, the manuscript age, when you're dealing with, for example, Roman and Greek authors, we know of their existence, we know they wrote things, but we have none of their texts. Or other classical authors of whom we have a very fragmentary memory, because their works were destroyed in the manuscript age. A library burning down is a very bad thing. A manuscript collection burning down is a cultural catastrophe. And I think that we need to think about the age we're embarking on, apparently, the digital age, and look at its resemblances to the manuscript age. Just then, as now, you couldn't really trust what you saw. You had no idea when you were looking at something what it claimed to be. It could be something that somebody had copied out and added their own interpolations. Just as today, it is perfectly possible to put a sex scene in the Book of Mormon if you've got it online and transmit it. In other words, we had this period, and we have this period, of fixity, authenticity, stability, of text that you can trust, text with edges, as was quoted earlier. And is it to be replaced by an era when everything is in doubt, when things are not only falsified, or de-authenticated, if there is such a word, but also vanish? Just think of websites. I mean, a website is like those peculiar structures you see in Paris where they paste posters for exhibitions and singers and so on them, and then they peel away and somebody pastes something over it. So you get this kind of collage of fragments of memory until it all goes away. How do you preserve a website? You take a snapshot of it every 5 seconds. In what form do you preserve it? And I'm not saying any of this to denigrate the great advances and the many good things that digitization has brought us. Principally, I would argue, in the field of information. But just to say that there are perils ahead, that there is danger that huge swaths of the human record will vanish or will be so altered as to be not usable. And in that environment, it is very important that we cling to two things. One is the dedication of a profession to the preservation of the human record, that is, of librarians and archivists, ensuring that documents of value are preserved and transmitted to the future. The other thing is to emphasize the importance of literacy. And by literacy, I don't mean the common kind of idea that literacy is a sort of hurdle. You know, one side you're illiterate, you jump over it, the other side you're literate. What I'm talking about is lifelong engagement with texts, the ability to interact fruitfully and productively with complex texts, with ever more complex texts. In other words, literacy is a lifelong process. And I'm very afraid that we are depriving our young people in particular of the opportunity to empower themselves, to become autonomous human beings in a world in which they can interact with complex texts by emphasizing the visual and the fleeting, and by pretending that looking something up on Google is doing research. You know, it's a staple of the more ignorant kind of talk show. Somebody will call in and say, I've done research into this topic. And Kennedy was killed by people from Mars because I saw it online. So the idea is that we should be educating people to be literate, to be able to interact with complex texts to a greater and greater degree throughout their lives, to get pleasure from it, as well as learning from it, and that we should emphasize the importance of critical thinking, of seeking the authentic, of trusting in expertise. Because Andrew Keen has a book called The Cult of the Amateur, where he's talking about the whole Web 2.0 thing as being, you know, the triumph of the slacker, the amateur, the person who feels they have something to say but doesn't really have very much to say. And we're drowning in this stuff. And one last thing I'd like to say about the book, because I have 4 minutes to go. I have my watch here. I also have your watch, so I have a double. Is that it is very easy to dismiss attachment to books as a vehicle for reading as nostalgia. And I'm thinking of three different things. One is my wife and I were at a cathedral in Rome during Mass, and they had a ceremony, and because it was all in Italian, I wasn't quite clear what the ceremony was, but anyway, they brought out an immense gold-bound volume of the Bible. And children, I think in possibly confirmation dresses, they weren't First Communion dresses, whatever it was, came up and kissed this volume, which was held out for them by the Archbishop. And I thought at the time, what is it they're kissing? Are they kissing the text? Are they saying that there's something behind this? This is just a carrier, it just happens to be bound in gold, but it could be just as well a paperback. Or are they saying there's something important about this object? And then, I live in Chicago, which is in many ways, of course, well behind New York, but I read the New York Times every day in a vain attempt to appear urbane and sophisticated. And I read 2 or 3 weeks ago about the paintings commissioned by Korean emperors. Did any of you read that? Of their bookshelves and so on. And they had these very elaborate paintings of, you know, shelves like this with objects on it and books and so on, because they didn't display the books. The books were all away in chests. But they felt that there was something very powerful and important about having these representations of the books that they owned, the intellectual power that the emperor commanded. And just this morning in the New York Times, there's a review of the last book of essays by the late William Styron. And he talks about being in a military-sponsored college program at Duke, which then as now possessed one of the great college libraries of America. He began to read voraciously, regarding the books in the Duke Library as the rocks and the boulders he could cling to against his onrushing sense of doom and mortality. I read everything I could lay my hands on, he said some 50 years later. Even today, I can recall the slightly blind and bloodshot perception I had of the vaulted Gothic reading room, the smell of glue and sweat and stale documents, winter coughs, whispers, the clock ticking toward midnight as I raised my eyes over the edge of Crime and Punishment. The library was my hangout, my private club, my sanctuary, the place of my salvation. Is there any current Duke student who is going to recall looking at a computer in the Duke University Library with that kind of emotion in 50 years from now? Thank you.
And now we have Jim Neal, and we'll save questions till after Mr. Neal speaks.
Good evening. I came to New York and to Columbia in the fall of 2001, and I agreed to give a series of presentations to Columbia alumni groups around the Mid-Atlantic region. That January, I found myself traveling down to Philadelphia to attend such a meeting. Driving in my car down the turnpike, got into Philadelphia. It was snowing, but I found the Holiday Inn where the meeting was going to be held, parked my car, walked into the hotel, found the room, set up with chairs, much like this one. My talk was to begin around 8 o'clock. By 8:15, there was only one other person there. I suggested I should go ahead with my presentation. He agreed. I was using slides that evening, and I asked if he would show the slides as I spoke. He agreed to do that. Gave a talk, very inspiring talk. Asked if there were any questions. He said no. I sat down on the front row briefly and thought about this terrible ride back to the city in the snow, and I said, well, I've got to get out of here. I've got to go up back to New York. He says, no, you don't. You're going to stay. I said, no. I've got meetings in the morning. I can't take the risk of being late. I've got to get back to New York. He says, no, you're going to stay. I said, you don't get it. I've got to get back to New York City. He says, no, you don't get it. I'm the second speaker tonight. So why that story? Well, first of all, I'm glad that you showed up. But also, I feel a certain anxiety tonight, similar to that evening. Addressing our digital future on the same program with my good colleague, Michael Gorman, in the context of this extraordinary and venerable New York Society Library. My basic position that I'll take tonight, for purposes of provocation, is that our future is defined by digital and network technology. Our learning, our scholarship, our work, our entertainment, our culture, our relationships, our economy, our legal system, the world of books and libraries, all types of aspects of our world are influenced by our dependence on computers, on electronic information, and on the internet and the web as tools for moving that information around. As we consider the book, let's remember what Abby Hoffman once said, sacred cows make the tastiest hamburger. Charles Corralt once said that thanks to the interstate highway system in the United States, I can travel from New York to San Francisco and see absolutely nothing. The content is important. It's an important part of the infrastructure. But if we listen to our users, particularly those users who I work with, the students and researchers in a Columbia context, they say, content is important, I want more and better content, but I want more and better access, I want convenience, I want to do things that I've never been able to do before, I want to manage my productivity, I want to control the information and the content and the technology, and I really want to try and experiment in ways that I've never been able to before. Much of our work in the digital environment, much of our thinking and execution of the digital book has been moving text online. That is not taking advantage of the full potential of the digital environment. Clearly, online information defies the limitation of space and time. More accessibility, more availability. But we also need to recognize other important advantages. The immediacy of the information that's delivered online. The enhanced searchability. The currency of that information. The ability to ask new questions, to propose new research investigations that we never were able to look at before. The dynamism and fluidity of the information online, the interdisciplinarity of working in the online environment, the collaborative potential of scholars and students and other users working together, the integration of various media, of bringing text and sound and tools and video into the common space, the linkability of information, information not standing on its own, but understood in terms of its relationship to other information. The interactive nature of working online, the ability of the machine to take over a lot of the work to allow me to focus on the knowledge and the intellectual aspects of working online, the ability to manipulate information, not just in the negative sense that Michael spoke about, which I acknowledge is a serious issue, but the ability to move objects around and to look at information and various tools through various dimensions. And the extraordinary encyclopedic nature of working online. The book limits the amount of information that we can transfer and communicate. Online, we can digitize huge quantities of information and package it in new, inciting, and important ways. But we can't set aside the important advantages of the book. Its portability, the ability to take it around where I want to go. Its durability. To throw that computer on the ground and smash it, and the inability to pick it up and use it again and access the information on it. I can throw that book on the floor, and I wouldn't do it. My preservation librarian would freak out, but I probably can pick it back up and use it again. The mark-up ability. And we know that students at Columbia love to tell the people who come after them in reading a book what they thought was important. The readability. And, of course, the technologies are advancing in terms of our ability to read information online. But there's nothing like the clarity and ability of working with the text in a printed. The archivability, as Michael noted, we have extraordinary resources in many of our research libraries, the papyrus and the cuneiforms in the libraries at Columbia sitting in our special collections that have survived for thousands of years. But information created in the last hour online very often is gone, never available to be used again. The affordability, the investments that's necessary to create and use electronic information versus my ability to walk down to Borders and to Barnes & Noble, for example, or into this library on a subscription basis and take out a book and use it. The ownability of a book and the ability to give that information contained in that book to someone else, that loss of ability online. The aesthetic quality of the book, what we enjoy and what we value. And in the scholarly context, what I call the ability of a young scholar to walk into their dean's office and throw their book on the table, and I call it the thumpability factor. There's something about being able to share your book in the printed form that you can't do in the online environment. George Bernard Shaw, the Irish playwright, was opening a new play in London. And he wrote to Winston Churchill, and he said, "Winston, I really would like you to be at the opening night's performance of my play, and I enclosed two tickets. One is for you, and one is for a friend, if you have one." Churchill quickly replied. He said, "Dear Mr. Shaw, unfortunately I have another commitment that evening, but I would be very appreciative if you sent me two tickets to the second night's performance, if there is one." I think the question that all of this debate around the future of the book often raises is the future of the library. Will there be one? We at Columbia continue to remain very focused on the whole array, aura and importance of knowledge acquisitions, synthesis, navigation, dissemination, interpretation, and archiving. We still care very much about getting, organizing, finding, delivering, educating, and preserving the scholarly and cultural record. But we also recognizing that we're taking on a lot of new roles. We're reaching beyond that legacy function and responsibility, being responsible for that centuries of recorded record that we make available in our libraries. We are an important part of the infrastructure of the university and the larger scholarly and teaching and learning world. We provide the buildings, we provide the technology, we provide the expertise that makes the system work. We are a repository responsible for centuries and centuries of the record, making sure that it will be available to future users. But we also are a gateway. We enable people to find information. Just like we select materials to bring into our library collections, we make similar selections in the online environment. Material and information of relevance and quality and authenticity to our user communities. We're also operating in the public interest. One of the things we often lose sight of is how this technology environment which we've created has thrown up a whole set of extraordinary national information policy issues, issues of privacy, intellectual freedom, who has access to the internet, how much do they pay, and not to speak of the extraordinary copyright and intellectual property issues that we are struggling with. We're building digital libraries, but we know in doing so, it's increasingly known to us that quality in terms of libraries is far more than content. We know that quality increasingly means content plus functionality. It's what I can do with it that increasingly matters. We have created a poverty of abundance, a sense that there's far, far more information than we're enabling and providing that people can use very well. We're licensing huge amount of published content from vendors all across the world. At Columbia, we provide access to 118,000 journals online. We are currently providing access through our library to over 3.5 million electronic books. We are digitizing huge quantities of material from our special collections. We've just done 15,000 letters of Herbert Lehman. We're doing 20,000 apartment brochures from throughout New York City from the 1920s and 1930s. Think of the extraordinary research that will take place in the use of those online databases. We also are reaching out to the web. We know that the web is an important authorship and publishing environment. We are selecting and downloading and archiving and cataloging content from the open web. We're gathering a lot of the literature produced within our university, the work of our faculty and students, and all types of media. We know that we need to integrate services, we need to integrate the librarian into that online environment, and more people need the tools to enable them to use that information well. But as also Michael noted, we need to think much more aggressively and in a much more deeper way about the preservation and archiving of that content. We need to serve as a repository. We can't preserve what we don't hold. We have to buy. We have to acquire. We have to possess something before we can preserve it. We need to make sure it's persistent, that it's accessible and usable over time. We need to curate it to make sure that it's secure and will always be there. And we need to be a steward. We need to care for it and make sure that it has that long-term availability. The analog world, we never really took great care of our printed collections. They were used, they deteriorated, they disappeared. We're converting a lot of content from print to electronic, and we don't know how to take care of that electronic record yet. We're trying to build more capacity in our library programs, in our collaborative efforts to preserve that record, but we are not doing a good job. And then we have all this born digital stuff, material that never had a life in print or in analog. And that clearly is information that requires our not only concerted effort within the library community, but it becomes a national, if not international, policy question in terms of the long-term preservation of that scholarly, educational, cultural record. Think about what's going on in the world of books, those who care about books, and the importance of technology and the internet to their work. There are extraordinary expansion in the databases about books, the ability to learn about books, to buy books online. There are global communities of bibliophiles, individuals who are very specialized interest in different aspects of book production and authors and use of books. And now they can talk together in rich communities about the things that they care about. The whole writing and the creative process has been revolutionized by the use of technology. This is a great concern to libraries like Columbia that have great manuscript collections from authors. We have all of the extraordinary letters that they've written and the versions of the books that they've composed. Those who write online, it's not clear that they're capturing all of the versions of the work and all of the editing that they have done. What a loss to literary scholarship and to history. Technology is helping us preserve the book. In some cases, by making a digital copy, it enables us to move the use online and to preserve and reduce the use and abuse of the individual printed work. The promotion and sale of books. We can move way beyond Amazon in terms of the way books are being promoted and bought around the world. The whole book production and book publishing community is totally dependent on technology. The whole notion of print on demand and not having warehouses of books. And then we come to the issue of digital books and how we can look at them as an important way to enhance the readability and usability of information. When we think about electronic books in libraries, and I mentioned we had over 3.5 million electronic books in the collections at Columbia, do we buy them or do we rent them? Increasingly, we rent them. Are they going to be posted by authors for free on the web? Or do people have sort of pretensions that they're going to make a lot of money by selling their works online? Is it going to be self-published? Are we dealing with an authorship revolution of the internet? Or is it going to be commercially published? Are publishers going to learn how to market their content through the web? Are we dealing largely with retrospective works, converting the historical books? Or are there going to be new books that are going to be written for the web? We had a Gutenberg E project funded by Mellon at Columbia where we funded 36 new PhDs in history to write their first book as an online monograph, not thinking about it as a printed book first, but as an online book. And we have seen some extraordinary outcomes from that effort. Is it going to be just text, or are authors going to be able and willing to integrate all kinds of media and tools into that environment? Is there going to be a proprietary technology that I have to buy this machine in order to read books? Or are there going to be open source and open format readers? Do I really care about reading an individual book? Or do I really want a database of books? Do I want an individual book about economic history? Or do I want 10,000 books about economic history provided in a database of books that allow me to look at relationships over time and to look at the linkages and development of economic history thought? It's an extraordinary world of digital publishing that's beginning to take place. And the whole and final point is the whole impact on reading and the consumption of information. Reading online versus reading from a printed text opens up the whole question about the physicality of working with something that you hold in your hand, the ability to turn the pages, the geography of reading, knowing where you have been and where you're going. That's very hard to conceive of and visualize in the movement of pages across the screen of a computer. The psychology, if you will, of using a 15th century manuscript of a work versus a paperback edition published last year. There's a certain psychological difference in handling the original versus a paperback. And we lose that sense of excitement and possibility online. The sociology of reading. Working on a computer is clearly, in many ways, a sole individual event, whereas reading from a printed text very often is a community event, a social event, reading to children in a children's library. And the whole notion, we don't understand the cognition, how people learn, how people absorb information in working in that online environment. There's a lot of talk here tonight about Web 2.0 and the social networking nature of creating sort of a collective intelligence a shared intelligence around the use of information. I think we need to begin to worry and think about Web 3.0, the whole notion that there is an extraordinary capacity in having a database of information and being able to apply artificial intelligence capacities to that printed electronic text, which is available online, to ask questions that we've never been able to ask before. The library role in this whole environment is diversifying rapidly. We know that there is a sense of a challenge to PTB, what I call the powers that be, sort of a questioning of authority. In the same way we question authority in the workplace or in society, I think we're beginning to question the authority of the author who writes a book. I think there's a low tolerance for what I call MBC, management by cliche. There's a sense that sort of traditional hierarchical and bureaucratic ways in which we think about relationships and think about relationships among information, that is, information building on each other to create the ultimate expression of that in the printed book, I think there's a huge erosion of that. So I think the whole notion of massively distributed collaboration on the web, scholars and students working together on a global scale, and what we were talking about earlier of constant partial attention, perhaps more than multitasking, but my grandchildren do not work in the same way that I work. So we come down to the point where we're not talking about a digitization of work and the born digital environment as an exception. We're increasingly talking about it as a rule. The mass digitization of text through Google, through Microsoft, the presence of works on the Internet Archive, conversion of analog collections taking place in our nation's libraries, archives, and museums, the realities of it are we know it's expensive. We think that it's a relatively easy and straightforward process to convert a printed text to make it an effective online work. It's an extraordinary and expensive and expertise-intensive process. We're living in a schizophrenic environment as well, where users, my faculty and students, are moving with some great difficulty between the traditional analog book environment and the electronic online multimedia environment. It's a sense of mutability, of constant change, of hybrid approaches, of concerns about authority and authenticity, not to speak of the unsupportive legal framework, the copyright environment, which we do not enjoy in this country today, which really raises questions about our ability to use technology and online digital works when we are threatened with lawsuits and the erosion of fair use as we've come to know it. But mass digitization creates opportunities. The breaking down of digital divides, knowledge divides, providing access to information in places and for people who may not have the economic resources or the national capacity to provide that type of support. We're also beginning to redefine the economics of information online, the notion of buying and owning a work versus renting and leasing a work, I think is something we should be concerned about, but one is very much redefining all aspects of the knowledge and information environment. Librarian of Congress Daniel Borstein once said that knowledge is never used up, for it increases by its diffusion and grows by its dispersion. And I think he would applaud, a traditional historian that he was, he would, however, applaud the extraordinary work going on at the Library of Congress today to make its extraordinary deep collections available on the web to a global readership. Albert Einstein, when he came to the United States, would not travel by plane, and he often went from city to city on a train. On one such trip, he was sitting there, and the young man came around to collect the tickets. And suddenly Einstein realized he couldn't find his ticket, and he started digging in his pockets. And the young man said, "Dr. Einstein, don't worry, you don't need to find your ticket." But Einstein persisted, and he crawled on the floor, and he lifted up his seat. And again, the young man said, "Dr. Einstein, please, you don't need to find your ticket." Einstein stood up, whirled around, looked the young man in the eye, says, "Young man, it is no longer a matter of whether I can find my ticket. It's a matter of where I am going." In some ways, digital and network technologies have forced us to spend too much time looking for our tickets and not enough time thinking about where we are going. And in conclusion, in libraries in particular, there is a sense of, I sense a real heightened level of anxiety, a real feeling of being anxious, a sense of apprehension and fear. And I'm reminded of what Marshall McLuhan said, our age of anxiety is in great part the result of trying to do today's jobs with yesterday's tools. Is the book one of yesterday's tools? I think we also feel a sense of disruption, sort of being thrown into disorder. And I recall what Clayton Christensen said in an interview, one of the litmus tests is that a disruptive technology enables a larger population of less skilled people to do things that historically only an expert could. The ATM environment, taking my money out of a machine at 12 midnight, getting my ticket at the airport out of a machine, scanning my own groceries in the supermarket. Where's the librarian in this future knowledge environment? And lastly, the sense of chaos, a sense of confusion, a sense of unpredictability. But I always remember what Henry Adams, it said in The Education of Henry Adams, chaos often breeds life, while order breeds habit. Libraries, publishing, the world of books is full of chaos, but it's also full of life. And that's why it's very important and very exciting for us to be talking about this topic tonight. Thank you.
Well, thank you both. And we'll open the floor up to the many, many questions that I think probably you all have. You know, we've heard words like access, experimentation, literacy, needing to wrestle with a complex text. And I would argue that both many of those words can apply to both of the sort of candidates before us. But of course, we're not here to vote book versus screen. And I think both gentlemen made it very clear that we probably are not facing a world without the book at the moment. And I would agree that the digital is not the exception. I'm not sure that I would use the word rule. I would agree that we need to wrestle with the complex text, as Mr. Gorman said, but I don't know that we are in, I'm not sure if we're as in much peril as he spoke about. And I'll throw out one little anecdote. When I was just researching my recent book on attention, the erosion of attention, I wanted to understand the etymology of the word distraction. It turns out that it first came into use in 1460. The Oxford English Dictionary Online nicely told me that I could find that first use of the word in a book called The Mirror of Our Lady, which was a kind of handbook for this wonderful, I guess, I don't know if convent is the right word, but sisterhood along the Thames. I found the book on Google Books, too, which was fantastic because I couldn't get this copy of this very rare 1460 book. Well, I found a few pages on distraction. It was actually an incredibly modern and comforting and forgiving definition of distraction and how to deal with it. But many, many of the pages were missing. And so I had my book, but not in completion. And I could, guesstimate, but I think in many ways it's a good analogy for how we're dealing with this world of cyberspace. And also, lastly, I'd say both the book and the screen are in process. We forget so often that the book is still in process, so that came to mind. But I have many questions. I don't know if you do. the gentleman over there?
When I was half teacher,
no.
Why not?
You really want to talk about it?
Yes, sir.
I'm a graduate. I have 2 degrees from that school.
Excellent.
I have 2 degrees from that school. And in 1990, the powers that be decided that this was not a school that would survive. Well, absolutely, and I think if they have the opportunity to restore it today, they would. I think at that point, the school had been somewhat isolated from the rest of the faculty, so they were academically isolated. Their graduates were not giving money back to the institution. Remember, we were librarians. And I think there also was perhaps a sense that they were not keeping up in the instructional and research environment with the new technologies. But I think it ultimately was a political battle between the provost and the faculty.
I shouldn't comment that. You have other library educators in the room.
And I'm sorry, I forgot to mention, I think we want to give the questioners a handheld mic. So the gentleman with the laptop.
So this is for James Neal. So Columbia students can access many books in full electronic form that are also on your shelves. Can you tell from your circulation statistics whether the existence of the digital copy increases or decreases the number of students trying to get the paper copy?
No, we can't tell that yet. The circulation of our book collections has held relatively steady, about 500,000 circulations per year. That's people who check the books out and remove them from the library. The use of the online is almost immeasurable in terms of the tens of millions of hits. Now, we don't know when people check a book out whether they're reading it, much less understand it. And we don't know whether they're, when they make a hit online, whether they in fact are consulting that information or moving on. We do observe, however, as we've digitized special collections, rare book and manuscript and archival collections, that the availability of that information online has led to a very significant, we measure, doubling in people coming to the special collections rare book libraries to consult and use that information in the libraries. So I think that's the only measure, Michael, we have at this point. We have not correlated that in the online environment with books and journals as yet.
I'm a physician, and I have access, of course, to 10,000 journals around the world, should I want to be interested in a particular subject. I was interested in the distinction, I assume, was being made between information and knowledge. Because I find that if I'm trying to look something up, I'm overwhelmed with information. I'm often underwhelmed by knowledge. And I wonder if one can comment on
it. Mr. Gorman?
Thank you. The future, indeed the present of the scholarly journal is very much in doubt. And I think the reason for it is very simple, is that we talk about electronic books when we shouldn't. We should talk about electronic texts. And similarly, an electronic journal is a kind of a nonsense. You know, the idea was of a journal that you would gather together articles on more or less the same topic and sell them all to somebody who would then use one or two of them. And, you know, all the studies show that 20% of the articles in any field account for about 80% of the use. Tremendous number of scholarly journal articles are generated as a result of the tenure process and read, if at all, by the author and his friends and relations. So we have an economic model where you were selling five things for every one thing that somebody wanted. And it's become very clear in the electronic environment that what people want is not journals, but articles. They don't want artificial bundles of articles that happen to be issued at the same time. And so we're faced with the electronic journal is sort of clinging on because the people who make money out of it hadn't yet worked out a way of making money out of selling individual articles. So that's the first point. The second point is that a work, a text, is the creation of a human mind. It's somebody who has taken information and turned it into knowledge, in interpreting it, and so on. And that work, that article, that text, has a beginning, a middle, and an end. What happens in the digital world all too often is that that product is atomized. That what people do is find some paragraph, think it's of some interest, read it, extract whatever little bit of information they can out of it. And the point is that I'm saying is that if you can use a paragraph from page 150 of a book or page 13 of an article out of context, then the book and the article weren't worth writing. The whole point of a book or an article is a progressive accumulation of information knitted together to form knowledge. And I think that there are great dangers in this atomization of text. It's taking the author's work and kind of shattering it. You know, it's the head of the Greek sculpture, not the entire sculpture that's there. And I think that we, in the field of medicine, I think the correspondence between information and knowledge is much closer than it is in many other fields. And it's why digitization, computerization has been very successful in fields such as medicine, in science and technology, and so on, and less successful, in my view, in the humanities, social sciences, where a text is not an accumulation of, you know, those of you who are like me, tribal Catholics, will remember that you can commit any number of venial sins. It doesn't all add up to a mortal sin. And you can add together all kinds of different facts and pieces of information, but unless it's shaped by the human mind, it doesn't generate knowledge. And I think that we ignore that too often. And one last thing I'd like to say, because I'm not saying that Jim did this, but it very often in these discussions, there are two kinds of digitization talked about. One is the digitization of existing texts, which I'm in general not in favor of. The other is the digitization of unique objects, of manuscripts, of special collections, of rare and precious things. And I think that's a tremendous contribution, the work the Library of Congress is doing in that field, making accessible things that were just hidden away in the Library of Congress and found nowhere else. That is a great contribution. So I think we should distinguish between these two kinds of digitization projects. And I'm sorry, that was far too long an answer.
And Mr. Neal will add a word.
A word, yes. I note and I agree with the distinctions among the types of digitization, but I think the digitization of text is an extraordinarily important and wonderful development because of the extraordinary research that can take place across that corpus of literature. I want to say the medical researchers at Columbia, where do they put their papers? They deposit their papers on their own personal websites. They deposit their papers at the National Library of Medicine at PubMed Central. They deposit their papers on a School of Medicine website. They put it up on the Columbia Institutional Repository website. They send it to a publisher who puts it in a publisher website. It really raises the question of version control, of the potential for manipulation, which version is going to get cited and passed on to posterity. So I agree with Michael that the journal, as we've come to know it, is not the tool for communication. It's the tool for personal advancement, and it has been the tool for long-term preservation. It's a packaging that made sense, but people don't want access to a journal. They want access to the research paper. And how we make that transition, I think, is going to be the challenge over the next decade.
Yes.
I wonder if the impending demise of the book is entirely due to the digital world, or is it? Yeah. very useful to hold it up here. Or is it in part because it seems a whole generation of children don't read books anymore? You don't start off with the habit. And is that more a function of your book, I guess, distraction, those little things and everything?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if children still read as they always used to do, would we be facing this, you know, the end of the book situation?
Well,
is my question.
That's a very good point. You know, I would say, and maybe it speaks to some of the remarks about the issue of access, and there's a issue of preserving what we have now or in the future, but really what worries me is the issue of how we will think deeply, and also, I would add, relate deeply, because communications in a diffused way has been shown study after study after study to be just that, in a diffused way. I mean, scientists who are studied as relying on email, and science is all about collaboration, if they are, if a scientist, a group of scientists are communicating right next door to each other, have access to each other physically, they'll collaborate twice or three times as often as those who rely on email. And that kind of deep collaboration, of course, is the lifeblood of science. So I do believe that at the crucial crux of the question is, study after study shows that, you know, children are not going deeply into the text. College students are not going deeply into the text. At UCLA, 80% of political science majors think that they score highest on use of websites, and yet 80% of those think that they do score high when most of them fail to actually evaluate the objectivity or the use of the text. And the Educational Testing Service exam that I was speaking of previously is a source of great worry across campuses. I've interviewed professor after professor who believes that we're entering a kind of culture of skimming. So, you know, will the book continue to allow us to go deeply and to think deeply, or can we have a print age, you know, to develop 500 years of a print age and the structure and architectures and framework for authenticity and depth? Maybe that will occur, but I don't think it's there yet. I think too many people with this wonderful access are just stuck on the surface of the text. And, you know, the lack of reading by kids is very, very worrisome. So, and then split focus is a whole other trouble.
This is a little bit in the same vein. I was wondering, isn't it really just as important, if not more important, that I think there's been a sea change in what education means? I went to a public school for the first 6 years of my life. We learned to diagram sentences. And most of us who are like are my age know the difference between me and I, you know, when you use what personal pronoun. And in eighth grade, you know, we memorized speeches from Julius Caesar, and we thought about it and talked about it. The teachers didn't let us get away with just skimming. And I think that was long before the internet hit. I look at my alma mater where we had distribution requirements, and to be an English major meant that you started with medieval literature and, you know, up to the moderns and then specialized, and that's not true anymore. So, you know, I think that has an awful lot to do. I mean, we had red marks put on our, I have my third grade, you know, notebook from a public school where I might add the teachers didn't go to teachers' college, I'm sorry, and they didn't know modern ideas, and they would mark something with a red line, and I don't think we were traumatized when we didn't start our sentence at the edge. There was a difference in what it meant to master something, I think.
Mm-hmm. So, would you like to?
About children and reading, my impression is that the children's book publishing industry is very strong. Very powerful, huge numbers of books published, and so on. But I think it's a victim of two things. One is this business of regarding literacy as some kind of hurdle, and we concentrate on those young children and whether they can read or not and test the hell out of them until they're zombies. Just concentrating on that, can they actually puzzle out the words on a page? and not the kind of thought that lies behind it. And I think that's one problem. The other problem is, and I hate to say this, but it's the encroachment of computers into K through 12 education. I lived for 20 years in Fresno, California, in the middle of the other California. You know, five of the poorest counties anywhere you could find in the United States around there. And a shocking education system, starved by, you know, the Proposition 13 and all the other terrible things that Californians do to each other. And the answer was always, let's get them computers. Well, you take a town like Palia, California, 98% Hispanic, children of migrant farm workers and so on, and give them computers, when what they need is people who teach them reading and teach them to love reading and the power of reading. And I think that using computers is a kind of a cop-out for very poor school areas. And I'm sure it can enhance, you know, everywhere I've gone in New York the last couple of days, I see these lines of affluent-looking kids walking together, you know, in crocodiles, God bless them. But I think their lives are probably enhanced by having computers. But there are millions of people who live in homes that do not have books, that don't read, where their parents don't read to them, and so on. And I think that we're neglecting that at our peril.
I would say that we have shattered so many hierarchies. It's no coincidence in this age of boundarylessness that both corporations and families don't have the kind of hierarchies of control that they had before. And that offers us an incredible, and humankind, an incredible opportunity for freedom and for creativity and for innovation. You know, it's a sort of springing from serfdom cognitively if we cannot lose the frameworks and architectures of thought that we were forced. And you know, when the teacher is an authority and now is just a discussant, when the parent is, you know, leading and guiding and now is just a friend, I'm not sure that we're really always making progress. And I was thinking very unscientifically about the idea that kids don't play with toys anymore, that they play with gadgets after about 8. And also their reading scores fall down around that time. And so many parents I hear say, well, this is the new thing. If he has 12 screens open on his computer while he's filling out his college application essay, he must be just doing something right because he is doing the new thing. And yet, do we listen? Have we ever listened to kids' wisdom about how our society progresses based on how they use their toys? I really think we need to think about that. Who's in charge?
Also, one of the things that I mentioned in the beginning, it may be true, total freedom and chaos and liberty and democracy, but one of you pointed out in the end, the expert is there in the background. We still quote the New York Times, it may be dime, but it controls the conversation of the nation, comes out of 42nd Street. So come on, in the end, the expert is hovering in new disguise, perhaps, but is, I think, sought just as much and depended on as much as ever, despite the illusion of total empowerment. I don't believe it.
I worked for the California State University system, and they've evolved this notion of a learning environment rather than a teaching environment. And my question was always, why would you pay money to sit in a room with someone who doesn't know any more than you do? I mean, the point is to learn from people who know more than you do. The other thought I have is, because I'm getting old, Jonathan Miller, I think, said that the way we become reconciled to death is that the world becomes increasingly unrecognizable. And I think maybe that's happening to some of us too.
We'll have two more questions.
Probably not the case in this august company, but I think I probably read more than my peer group normally. That's the impression I get when my friends come over to my apartment and they're kind of like, wow, I can't believe you have all these books sitting around, you know, that kind of thing. But I certainly spend more time on the internet than I do in a book, partially because it's sitting there in front of me at work. And I can do something online without looking quite as odd as I would be if I pulled out a book and started reading. And I love the internet. I might start looking at Abraham Lincoln and then the Ford Theater and then the Ford Motor Company and then vulcanized rubber and, you know, public transportation. But I wonder if there's been any research on how many words are there on an average web page and how much time people spend on one compared to, obviously, a book.
I know that's a source of great interest to advertisers, but I don't know the answer. I do know that the average worker keeps 12 windows open on their screen at all times, so there is a kind of continuous partial attention there. But as far as the eyeball time, I don't know. I think we'd all agree that you can skip and skim around in a book just as much, but the nature of the screen is such that it does prompt you. It preys on your in attention science, and television is built this. In attention science, things that grab novelty, or we are born to be interrupted. We're born to pay attention to the novel, the shiny, the bright. That's why babies' TV is such as it is, because basically a child can't actually look away from the screen because the TV is built to prey on their survival skills and whether or not they learn anything. So it is an alluring mechanism, but you can read comic books all your life too and skip around and never actually deal with a book either.
I've always been intrigued by the concept of surfing, because after all, when you think about it, you're skimming across the surface, and what do you know of fish if you surf? And you end up face down in the sand at the end.
I think we have one more question. I'm sorry, maybe one more.
Okay. I just wanted to get back to an issue that's been mentioned by both speakers, and it deals with the notion of what obligation we think our libraries in this country have. Traditionally, for libraries around the world, they assumed responsibility for their books. They listed in their national library the books that were published in that country, and they copyrighted them and did things like that. But for their journals, they left that to their discipline. So the abstracting and indexing services were run by the disciplines, chemistry, biology, and access to the books came through Library of Congress catalogs, etc., and OCLC and things like that. But now, when we hear from the speakers, if the article is the new unit of service and not the journal, so I'm thinking of New England Journal of Medicine, which the journal itself has editorials and advertising and all kinds of rich feature articles, that gets lost when I access each of those as a separate piece. But the provision of that volume, where we would send it out, we in the library field would send it out to a bindery, and we would bind up a volume of that and put it on the shelf, and we did that redundantly around the country in all the major libraries, but that gave that journal book status, because it sat as a bound volume. And we owned it, and as Jim said, we could give it to another person. But now the publishers own that work. They won't let us do that. We can't print it up. And so an obligation that we assumed for the society, that we would preserve the bound volume on the shelf of the journals, where we stitch them together, etc., that's now lost, right? Am I right about this? So what happens with that assumed obligation that our society expects the library field to do?
I think we've talked about the demise of the book. It's not in demise. More books were published last year around the world than ever before. We bought and cataloged 200,000 new books into the collections at Columbia last year. However, we spent 35% of our acquisitions budget on access to electronic information. And I looked at the numbers this morning about the other major research libraries in North America, and some are spending 50 to 80%
of their budget on leasing information rather than buying information. I think the journals are alive. I mentioned 118,000 electronic journals. Those, in fact, are journals. But as we watch people search and use that, they are really attracted to the research article. I think Michael is correct. It's a packaging device. There is a set of journals like the New England Journal of Medicine that I think has, like the New York Times, has its own sort of power and magnetism that people go for, and they use that that other set of information that's provided. It's almost become a religion. I'm a digital person, or I'm a book person, and we have a certain, in some quarters, people are embarrassed to be seen with a book. In other quarters, people are embarrassed to be seen looking and reading online. It's almost like what the Episcopal bishop said to the Baptist minister, brother, we both serve the Lord, you in your way and I in his. There's a certain self-righteous nature of how we view the media. We use the word versus all the time, print versus electronic, virtual versus physical, and versus is the wrong word as we describe today's information world. It's and all the time. People need to be literate and able to move across the media, whether it be print or electronic. What's most important, we've referenced it a couple of times here tonight, it's knowing what is relevant, what is of sufficient quality, authenticity, and authority to be able to answer your question, enable you to move forward with confidence with the information that you have in hand.
Well, I think we are a very attentive and in-depth audience, but it is getting late, and I think we'll wrap things up for tonight, and because obviously we could wrestle with these issues all evening, with the ghosts of generation of readers hovering above us. But I'll just leave you with one final word, and it speaks to the gentleman's remark a minute ago, and I think to Mr. Neal and Mr. Gorman's remarks. So if we're in an age of freer knowledge, and if we're authors and publishers all, and if we are floating in this unbounded milieu of information, trying to go deeply and make sense both of our lives and of our knowledge, then we should always remember that freedom begets responsibility, as you said, or the wisdom of the crowd degenerates into the ignorance of rabble. And so in an election year, I think, to paraphrase a long-gone president, ask not what the book can do for us, but we should ask what we can do for the book. To read, says the linguist David Crystal, is to invent. And so I have two suggestions as you go forth into the night, and the library goes dark just for tonight. I didn't mean to rhyme that, but take a child by the hand, metaphorically or not, and help them do more than scratch the surface of the text. Teach them about Amazon and Wikipedia and how it really works, and about the book and about the stacks. And above all, teach them about the discomfort and confusion, and finally, the rewards that come with deep reading. Don't let them skim and click and point and depart, because no one is spoon-fed an epiphany. Second, wrestle with the text ourselves. Keep wrestling. You know, the book historian Robert Darnton said of Samuel Johnson's library that his books were bent and battered as if he wrestled his way through them. It's a lovely image. We need to keep pushing the envelope of our reading. And we need to get lost in the forest of a digital database and then tell a librarian what signposts could have helped lead us to the light. We need librarians to help us build architectures of learning, but we need to be their collaborators. So in a transitional age, I've heard, individual actions actually matter more. And that's why we should be inventors, we should wrestle with the text, and we should remember a line from Victor Hugo: cemeteries take what they are given. Thank you.
We do have books for sale, two books by Mr. Gorman and one of Maggie Jackson's books. Thanks for all coming tonight. Great evening.